Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Socrates, narrated by Lynn Redgrave, Part 7.
In this passage, it could not be clearer that Plato's Socrates thinks the opinions of the majority are actually dangerous. If we take their opinion seriously, we risk ruining our souls. In Plato's writings, Socrates has two favorite refrains. The first is that the soul is benefited by justice and injured by injustice. The second is that hoi polloi hold dangerously misguided views of what justice and injustice really are. The implication, then, is starkly anti-democratic. Socrates thinks that most people are unfit for political power. But it doesn't follow from this anti-democratic bias that Socrates instead favors oligarchy. Some observers have noted that Socrates was friendly with two of the most notorious Athenian oligarchs, Critias and Charmides. These men later led the so-called 30 tyrants who subjected Athens to a reign of terror. But while Socrates may have admired the intellectual capacities of these two friends, there is no independent evidence that he approved of their political views. There's also no evidence that the friendship endured after they took control of the city. In fact, in his speech to the jury, Socrates reports that he had openly defied the 30 when they had ordered him to engage in injustice.
The 30 once summoned me as a fifth person into the rotunda, and they ordered me to bring back a certain Leon of Salamis so that they could kill him. They gave many such orders to many people, since they wished to implicate as many as possible in their crimes. But then I, not by word, but by deed, showed that death mattered nothing to me. But it mattered everything to me that I do nothing unjust or impious.
Socrates opposed democracy particularly because it places power in the hands of persons who know nothing about justice and injustice. Oligarchy is based on the assumption that owning property makes you suited to participate in politics, but this doesn't guarantee a knowledge of justice either. In fact, Socrates' interrogations lead him to conclude that the wealthy are as likely as anyone else to be self-deceived about the most important moral matters. We may conclude from all this that Socrates endorses neither democracy nor oligarchy. He does strongly prefer rule by moral experts, but there's little reason to expect that anyone will ever acquire the moral wisdom needed to be virtuous. Even though it would be misleading to say either that Socrates was a democrat or an oligarch, there is some reason to think that of these two options, he favors democracy. One of the basic characteristics of Athenian democracy was its commitment to what they termed paresia, or freedom of speech. As Athenians saw it, democracy means that all citizens are political equals, and this requires that all citizens have the same right to say what is on their minds. As long as democratic Athens remained true to her values, Socrates could engage in philosophy. But as his trial and execution shows, even democratic Athens had her limits. Socrates tells the jury that no other Greek city would have allowed him to speak freely either.
A fine life I would have, a man at my age, going away and passing from one city to the next, always being driven out. Know well that wherever I would go, young men will listen to what I say, just as here. And if I drive them away, they will persuade their elders to drive me away. And if I do not drive them away, their fathers and relatives will drive me away on account of these young people.
In Plato's dialogue entitled Crito, Socrates imagines the laws of Athens speaking to him. The laws remind him that he chose to live in Athens his entire life.
But you chose neither Sparta nor Crete, which you are always saying are well governed, nor any of the other Greek cities, nor any barbarian city. But you left home less than the lame and the blind, and other disabled people. Thus, it is clear that the city, and we its laws, are loved by you so much more
than other citizens.
As long as democratic Athens is more tolerant of his philosophical pursuits than other cities would have been, Socrates has reason to stay there. Socrates, therefore, has a reason to choose democracy over other forms of government, in spite of what he sees as democracy's flaws. Socrates believes that democracies are likely to pass bad laws, so the question is, are we morally obligated to obey those bad laws? Plato's dialogues seem not to provide a consistent answer. In the Apology, for example, Socrates tells the jury what he would do if they abridged his freedom of speech by ordering him to stop engaging in philosophical examination.
If you were to say to me, Socrates, we will not now be persuaded by Anytus, but will let you go on this condition. You will no longer spend your time in investigation or philosophy, and if you are discovered doing this again, you will be put to death. If then you would release me on these conditions, as I say, I would tell you that I respect you and I love you, men of Athens. But I will be persuaded by the god more than by you. And as long as I draw breath and am able, I shall not stop engaging in philosophy.
Some commentators have argued that Socrates is clearly announcing in this passage that there is at least one order he would violate, and that is an order to stop engaging in philosophy. These scholars also argue that Socrates recognizes one type of law, the law of God, as being higher than any human law. When divine law and human law conflict, the lower human law must give way to the higher divine one. On the other hand, in Crito, Socrates apparently defends the opposite view, declaring that he is bound to follow Athenian law at all costs, even if it costs his very life. As the dialogue opens, Socrates' friend, Crito, comes to him in prison while he is awaiting execution. Crito is a man of some means, and he tells Socrates that he is willing to make the necessary arrangements to allow his escape. Socrates answers by asking Crito to imagine with him what the laws of Athens would say about this plan to escape.
You should either persuade the city or do whatever she commands and suffer if she commands you to suffer, keeping silent, to be beaten or imprisoned, or if she leads you to war, to be wounded or killed. You must do these things. It is just to do them, and you must not give way or retreat or abandon your position. But in war and in the law court and everywhere, you must do whatever your city and country commands, or persuade her as to what is naturally just.
As Socrates conceives the laws, they do not require blind obedience. The laws recognize that they can be mistaken. Moreover, the laws remind Socrates again that he chose to live under them. He could have gone elsewhere, but he stayed in Athens. Socrates imagines what the law would say about this.
We proclaim, by having created this opportunity to any Athenian who wishes, when he has become a man and has seen the ways of the city and us the laws, he may take up his possessions and go wherever he wants. Not a single law forbids him or stands in his way. If any of you wish to go to a colony, if we and the city are not pleasing, or to go somewhere else to live as an alien.
By electing to stay, Socrates has received great benefits from life in Athens.
Did we not give you birth? And through us, did not your father marry your mother and engender you? Tell us. Do you find anything wrong with those of us, the laws that concern marriage, or with those that concern the nurture of a child and the education in which you were educated? Did those laws not give orders correctly about these things, when they ordered your father to educate you?
Socrates' point here is that individuals and the state will always have disputes about what justice requires, and no state can survive such disputes unless there is some authoritative way to determine who is right. According to Socrates, the laws demand that they should rightfully prevail in such disputes. After all, Socrates implicitly agreed to live under these laws when he continued to stay in Athens. In some ways, this argument in Crito seems simply inconsistent with what Socrates says in Apology. In Crito, Socrates is arguing for the authority of the law, but in Apology, he vows to never abandon his divinely imposed duty to philosophize, even if the law demands it. Isn't this simply a contradiction? The answer, surprisingly, is no, because the jury has no authority to order Socrates to abandon philosophizing. They are required by law to choose between the sentence suggested by Meletus, who proposed that Socrates be put to death, and the counter-proposal by Socrates that he pay a fine of 30 minas. The assembly could not have issued a valid order for Socrates to stop engaging in philosophy. Socrates believed the god had ordained him to philosophize. He would have considered an order to cease philosophizing to be a violation of the Athenian law forbidding impiety. It should be emphasized that Socrates is not saying that a citizen must always obey the law in each and every circumstance. On the contrary, Socrates makes it clear that the persuade or obey doctrine applies only when certain conditions are met. The citizen must have the right to argue that the law is wrong, and the legal system must aim at producing justice, even though particular laws within that system may sometimes be unjust. Socrates' position about obeying the law, therefore, does not apply to certain totalitarian regimes. But where the proper conditions are met, and when the citizen fails to persuade those who make and enforce the law, Socrates thinks that justice requires the citizen to do what the law commands. This reasoning has not been universally adopted, especially in modern times. In his essay entitled Civil Disobedience, the American philosopher and essayist Henry David Thoreau argued that the citizen has only one obligation, to scrupulously follow his or her conscience. Thoreau says it is irrelevant whether or not one has benefited from the legal system or whether or not the legislature is trying to pass a just ordinance.
Must the citizen, for a moment, or in the least degree, resign his conscience to the legislator? Why has every man a conscience, then? I think we should be men first, and subjects afterwards. It is not desirable to cultivate a respect for the law, so much as for the right. The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think is right.
Indeed, Thoreau believes that when a legal command offends a citizen's conscience, it's not even necessary for that citizen to explain why he or she cannot comply. In the 20th century, Martin Luther King also argued that a citizen has a right and, indeed, a duty not to obey an unjust law. But unlike Thoreau, King tied this right to a theory of natural law.
One may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal, but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is not a law.
Of course, this raises an important question. How does someone determine whether a law is just or unjust? According to the 13th century philosopher and theologian St. Thomas Aquinas,
an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and the natural law.
The just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or with the law of God. An unjust law is therefore a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. In other words, any law that uplifts human personality is just, and any law that degrades human personality is unjust. Socrates differs from those who advocate civil disobedience, such as Thoreau and King, in at least two ways. First, Socrates believes that obedience to the law, even if it seems unjust, is our only reasonable assurance against anarchy. No society would agree to let every citizen decide for himself where justice lies and whether to obey the law. A citizen who is free to leave, but who has chosen to live in a particular civil and legal order, has implicitly agreed to let the state decide whether the law is just. If Socrates is right, modern thinkers like Thoreau and King have failed to recognize this implicit agreement about how to adjudicate legal and moral disputes. A second difference is that advocates of civil disobedience believe that a person who carries out an unjust law is himself acting unjustly. By contrast, Socrates believes that if a person obeys an unjust law, then the injustice lies with the law, not with the citizen who obeys it. Socrates' counsel is clear. If you cannot, in conscience, comply with the law, and if you cannot persuade the authorities to change the laws, then you must leave the city, state, or country that's responsible for the unacceptable laws. The debate between Socrates and Dr. King, then, would likely be over whether it is unjust to remain in a country if one cannot, in good conscience, obey its laws. A common thread that runs through all of Socrates' thought involves religion. Socrates was tried, convicted, and condemned to death on the charge that he was impious. The three specifications of this charge were that he did not believe in the gods that the state believed in, that he invented new divinities, and that he corrupted the youth. Scholars used to think that these religious charges were made to hide the true political motivations behind the prosecution, but more recent arguments show that the religious charges were probably the actual focus of Socrates' trial. The key question becomes, exactly how are the prosecutors able to convince the Athenian jurors that Socrates is criminally impious? In Plato's Apology, Socrates clearly denies all the charges in his comments to the jury. He goes so far as to characterize himself not only as innocent of the charges, but even more innocent than his accusers are. He reminds the jurors of their oaths to judge according to the law and justice. He also explains why he would not convince them to break their holy oaths, even if it might lead to his release.
Clearly, if I would persuade you and force you to break your oaths, I would teach you not to believe there are gods. And in making my defense, I should really accuse myself of not believing in the gods. But that is not at all the way it is. I do believe in them, O men of Athens, more than my accusers do. And I leave it to you and to the God to judge regarding me, and decide what will be best for me and for you.
Like Plato, Xenophon regards Socrates as entirely innocent of the charges.
I am amazed, therefore, how the Athenians could have been persuaded that Socrates was not temperate regarding the gods. When he never did anything impious against the gods, neither by word nor deed, but what he said and did regarding them were always the words and deeds of one who deserves to be recognized as a most pious man.
From these accounts, it's difficult to understand how Socrates could have been charged with impiety. But Plato's account offers a key to why the Athenians would make such a mistake. Socrates claimed that his trial derived from what he calls the first accusations, which, as we've seen, were used to slander him long before his prosecutors actually indicted him. Socrates characterized the first accusations early in his defense speech.
There is a Socrates, a wise man, a thinker about the things in the heavens, and who has inquired into the things under the earth, and who makes the weaker argument the stronger. People who hear such accusations think that those who investigate these things also do not believe in the gods.
Socrates claims that these accusations are completely false. They derive from a vicious distortion of his philosophical activities, activities which amount to no less than a religious mission.
This is the end of Part 7. Please download Part 8 to continue.